Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio.
We are live, and
there's no music to begin the show. Only fireworks that are going to be happening sometime soon. Today is July 3rd, 2013. And instead of an early morning Wednesday show, we're going to have this late night 10 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm just going to go ahead and continue reading Dr. Herbert Roberts talking about phenomenal, logical type of view of medicine and science and how we think. There'll be some news, and if anybody wants to get on the chat, talk to me. I am here. It is 10 p.m. and thinking about the future and the present. Let me just tell you that on Homeopathy World Community, there's tons and tons of articles, and I post up quite a bit about vaccinations. I'm going to give you a heads up for tomorrow's show at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. We're going to have Alan Phillips, Greg Glazer, and Rich Roberts. All three of them are going to have a talk. Alan will be talking about public and private school exemptions. And then the other guys are going to get on and talk about legal issues and news. And to give you a little information about that, I've posted on Homeopathy World Community the Independent Thinkers Vaccine Fact Sheet. Yes, you must be an independent thinker in today's age. When we get news every day and we must question what is happening in our world. And, you know, everybody's giving each other, sending each other emails and posting things on Facebook and Twitter. We are the newsmakers. I received one today. The U.S. Postal Service is logging all mail for law enforcement. What does this mean? Not only are all of our digital interactions being logged and stored, reviewed, and data mined, we also have a notice from Washington that Leslie James Pickering noticed something odd in his mail last September, a handwritten card apparently delivered by mistake with instructions for the postal workers to pay special attention to the letters and packages that were sent to his home. Show all the mail to the supervisor for copying prior to going out on the street, read the card. Did you realize that all of your mail is being scanned and photographed as a permanent? We don't know actually whether it is a permanent archive or whether it is there for a temporary amount of time, but just the concept that your mail could be censored, could be opened, could be reviewed, and they might be keeping a tally on what it is that you are doing. This one gentleman was targeted for a long-time surveillance system. It's called Mail Covers, a forerunner of a vastly more expansive effort, the Mail Isolation Control and Tracking Program, in which Postal Service computers photograph the exterior of every piece of paper mail that is processed in the United States. That's 160 billion pieces last year alone. It's possible that we are producing less mail, less snail mail because of the digital era, but that's still a lot of mail. Together, the two programs show that postal mail is subject to the same kind of scrutiny that the National Security Agency has given to telephone calls and emails. The question is this legal? Is this an invasion of privacy? Probably not, because they're only scanning the outside, which is public, can be seen, and you are handing over your articles, whether they're letters, packages, to the Postal Service, which is an agency that you're probably I don't know whether you've had to sign something, but once you get put it into their hands, they can do with it
what they wish, I presume. The Male Isolation Control and Tracking Program was created after the anthrax attacks. That was in late 2001, if you remember. It killed 5 people, including 2 postal workers. Highly secret, and it seeped into the public view last month when the FBI cited it in its investigation of ricine-laced letters sent to President Obama and Mayor Michael Bloomberg. So every time we have an incident that puts security personnel at risk, or there is some sort of a crime going on, then this is gives them the ability to go in and scan all mail. So that's just for your interest. Now we're going to go ahead and talk about a couple of things that I've got going on the Facebook pages. A GMO bill cleared for the first reading. The council sends proposal to the public hearing. Larger venue yet to be determined. Quote, 500 to 1,000 jobs isn't worth the health of 30,000 other people. And you know, it's feel like it's time to put human health over corporate wealth. And what is this about? This is about, there's an article on the Garden Island, and the Kauai County Council unanimously voted to move forward a bill that would allow the county to govern the use of pesticides and genetically modified organisms on the island. During his closing remarks, Councilman Tim Bynum, who co-introduced Bill 2491, along with Councilman Gary Hooser, described the issue as serious. Quote, we're talking about people's lives, people's livelihoods. There are very sincere and passionate people on both sides. And after 6 hours of testimony from dozens of local residents and biotech company employees, the council approved the bill on the first reading. And so we're learning that, is it possible that people in their locale, local regions, can take on the or the to have GMO in the area. It calls for it appears that I must have been disconnected for a good number of minutes, and I didn't even know it. So I will refresh again a couple of quotes. One is by Ann Tran on Facebook and Twitter, who says, quality is never an accident. It is always the result of high intention, sincere effort, intelligent direction, and skillful execution. It represents the wise choice of many alternatives. That is a quote by William A. Foster. As parents, we must be the protectors of our children. We must also protect ourselves and our partners. We must protect in our community, in our neighborhoods, in our schools. And that is done by reading, studying, learning, considering, discussing with others, and then deciding what is best for each of you as an individual, as a family, and as a community, based upon actual factual information that you have and your own personal observations. What is happening to you? Are you noticing things based on information about how you feel, what it is that you're eating or noticing in your environment? I started off a little bit earlier about the Independent Thinkers Vaccine Sheet. Modern medicine tells us that we must vaccinate our children. Vaccines are also developed for adults. Most of us believe these injections are insurance policies for our health. Is that true? So we always have to question as we get information or recognize changes in our own health, changes in the health of entire populations. The reality is that vaccinations have never in all history diminished the incidence of disease. But you're not going to hear that from the medical community. That is information that you're going to have to find out on your own through other sources. And then there's a whole list of 10 facts that you should know. And they are: 1, vaccines are made from live pathogens grown or cultured in animal blood, animal tissue, chicken embryos, and aborted human fetal cells. 2, vaccine cultures are preserved with neurotoxins such as mercury, thimerosal, formaldehyde, phenol, aluminum, and MSG. These toxic mixtures are directly injected into babies, children, and adults, bypassing the body's built-in filters. The cilia in the nose, the tonsils, the skin. Childhood vaccinations, this is 3, are the first assault on the normal functioning of the body, creating neurological damage and debilitating the immune system. Humans have been evolving on the planet for so many thousands of years. Did we always have these vaccinations as a protection? Or did we grow together in harmony with our environment in a way that our body had a built-in protective system, a built-in way to deal with any foreign material? 4, today's children are routinely vaccinated by pediatricians performing what they believe to be preventative medicine. By the age of 6, most children have been exposed to more than 100 viral strains. And I am not sure whether they're saying that those viral strains are from the vaccinations that have been given through the pediatrician's office, or whether those are the natural strains, because certainly humans and babies have come into contact with so many viral strains. Certainly the vaccines are not able to cover all of them. 5, vaccines are frequently administered in combination, as in measles, mumps, rubella, and that we call MMR. However, in nature itself, one would never encounter this type of multiple viral load. It's an imposition on the system, on the human being. And we also know through Dr. Samuel Hahnemann that the body can only cope with one disease at a time. 6, with repeated injections, the damage caused by vaccines can lead to developmental problems, autoimmune disease, sudden infant death, that's SIDS, autism, and more. And we do know about the incredible statistical increases in all of those kinds of diseases that change the dynamics in an entire family, stress, the emotional, mental, and financial health of the family members, and this could be due to the repeated injections. 7, 1 out of 5 American children now has special needs. It's 1 out of 5. And America has the highest rate of these kinds of problems and gives the most vaccinations. Is there a statistical correlation there? These include learning disabilities, attention deficits, and behavioral issues. 8, contrary to popular belief, parents are not legally obligated to vaccinate their children. I think most people would not realize that is true, although they're making it much more difficult for people to take their right for an exemption or waiver for medical, religious, or philosophical reasons, and go to the NVIC portal, nvic.com, advocacyportal.com, to find out what's going on in your state. Number 9, plagues such as smallpox and polio were never eradicated by vaccines. Smallpox declined with improved sanitation, and polio persists under many new names. So there's a lot of trickery and deception that go on for vaccines, the vaccine marketing, and changing, taking the symptoms and giving it a new category to change the numbers on and rates of diseases. Number 10, the United States vaccinates more than any other country. Beware of future pandemics and federal imposition of mandatory vaccinations. Well, we'll get back to some of this, but I do want to cover Dr. Herbert Roberts and the phenomenological viewpoint for the 4th of July holiday and find out about what he is talking about. My favorite doctor, Dr. Herbert Roberts, he is the person who I've been reading The Principles and Art of Cure. He was born in 1868 and died in 1950. And he was a prominent homeopath and author. So we are going to go ahead with the reading. And hopefully you can keep up with me. I know it gets to be kind of heavy reading sometimes, especially last week on endocrinology. It gets to be heavy, but if you can tune in and concentrate a little bit, you'll reap a lot of benefit from learning from him. So he says in the introduction to his book, and he's talking about Oliver L. Reiser, R-E-I-S-E-R, associate professor of philosophy at the University of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. He tells us that the one possible method from the book Philosophy and the Concepts of Modern Science in 1935, the one possible method of integrating the vast and unwieldy masses of facts of the sciences into meaningful wholes, the adoption of the phenomenological, say that 3 times fast, viewpoint is recommended. By phenomenology, we mean it's a study of that which exhibits or displays itself. It is the descriptive point of view obtained by viewing the thing as a whole. Much of the trouble comes from an overemphasis upon microscopic details. Thus, it comes about that we can no longer see the forest for the trees. So very often we have a quote that says, God is in the details. Well, it's true. God is in the details. That spirit of the microscopic, beyond microscopic, the intricacy, the complexity of all the interworkings of everything, that we have to leave to God, really. And the more you probe, you might pick out something and you don't know how to put it back. You know, like, let's say you take the car apart or you take the clock apart and you take out all the pieces. And when you reassemble it, you're left with a piece that the clock might be working, or maybe it's not working, and there's a piece that's still left out. So sometimes we have to leave it to the big, the great creator. So anyway, he says, thus it comes about that we can no longer see the forest through the trees. So you're supposed to see us as a whole. That's why we're called holistic medicine. One of the really great discoveries of recent times is what has been termed the principle of uniformitarianism by the geologists. That is, the theory that the forces now at work are identical in nature with those that produced changes in past ages. So that there's some sort of uniformity in
the forces, I would say the physical forces, that move nature. If we take this phenomenological view of science today, we cannot help but see the Reiser's comment on the overemphasis upon microscopic details as being the source of multiplied data and chaotic theories of cause, action, and effect is all too true. And, you know, maybe he knew about the genetic coding back when he was writing. I'm not sure he did. But, of course, he did talk about looking in the microscope at the smallest germs, bacteria, and viruses. The strain of application of the microscope has produced a mental and philosophical astigmatism that permits each part to attain disproportionate focus in the whole. So you can see that when you put on a new set of glasses and you narrow your vision to looking into the microscope, and it's fascinating, it's phenomenal that you can do this and see a whole new world under the microscope living. But how exactly does that relate to each person, each living organism as a whole? Medicine in particular needs to view the whole and to take into consideration the principle of uniformitarianism. So far, as has been acknowledged by eminent authorities in the dominant school, homeopathy alone has offered such a unified theory that embraces the cause of disease conditions, the course of the condition and its prognosis, and at the same time, the method of approach to the remedial agent and the prognosis of its action upon the patient based upon the knowledge of the patient, the knowledge of the remedy, and a comprehension of the laws and their expression in varying states of health and disease. And he's almost like talking like Einstein when he says the unifying theory. So wasn't Einstein looking for the unifying theory that made all of the universe work? This is another way of saying that the homeopathic concept of disease and cure is from the phenomenological viewpoint, in that it considers the broad outlines of the whole rather than some of the minutest divisions compassed by microscopic vision, and at the same time embraces the meaning of which the microscopic vision demonstrates but a part. So it can be reflective, this microscopic vision, like a fractal. It can be a reflection of the whole. But the question is, how do we use our vision to see the world, the universe, ourselves, our identity, our purpose, our meaning, and our health? It is safe to say that the revelations in science yet to come are even more vital and far-reaching than those already exhibited. The specialist in specific branches of medicine, medical investigation, can furnish us vast and detailed information based on his microscopic findings. Yet, as homeopathic physicians, we cannot permit ourselves to be hampered by details to the exclusion of the whole. Definitely. Homeopaths are into details. We take down every detail. We want to know every modality. We want to know every etiology. We want to know the history. We want to know the hereditary factors. We want to know so many details. But the most important thing is not to be hampered by these details to the exclusion of the whole. We are privileged to view all these findings as a part of the universal application of a law under which we work. For man is naught if he be not a part of the universe and subject to its laws. So we are subjects, we are servants to the laws of the universe, to the laws of nature, which we spoke earlier were the uniformitarianism, that there were always forces in nature that moved and created the evolution of the planet, and we're still under those same forces. Because man's adaptation is highly specialized, we are able to correlate through a study of his health variations and the fundamental laws of the universe, as far as we can determine these. You know, he's saying we're constantly learning more about the laws of the universe. Our knowledge of each towards greater comprehension and applicability of the greater to the individual problem. Animal life, like vegetable life, has a high degree of adaptability to environment and proves the most delicate laboratory we have for our examination. Yet the mineral kingdom furnishes us with an unsuspected link in our chain of evidence. Thus, in conformity with statistical laws, we find again and again that the regular reaction of response of an individual is true of a group of individuals. So he's saying that we respond as a group as well as individuals, and that we can learn something from the mineral kingdom just as much as from the animal kingdom. With the necessary dedications for personal idiosyncrasies, and further, that what is true of a group of individuals may be true of any other group in nature under similar conditions, so far as we can measure the reactability of these other groups. So we're measuring reactions. How do individuals react? How do groups react under a certain set of circumstances? This uniformity of results is unquestionably due to what we term universal energy, which may be expressed again in very modern terms as those basic electrons, protons, neutrons, which are radiate, electric, and magnetic, the very definition of potential energy. So today we're reading news about the Egyptian people and their desire for freedom. What happens on all sides? It says Egypt's military shuts down the news channels. Why would they be doing that? There's latest breaking news all around the world, and we're finding out really in real time how groups of people act under certain sets of circumstances and how much of a pressure on a set of peoples it takes to find a response, to see a response, and what type of response. And back and forth, all the different groups, how they will react to each other and to the set of responses that are being given. So now, Dr. Herbert Roberts says, while energy has a certain stability of reactivity, it has selective action. Every portion of the human frame has a selective action over its function. It is susceptible to certain influences, constructive and destructive, and reacts selectively. Each atom of the human frame has a potential susceptibility to certain influences and has developed selectively and according to the principles of uniformitarianism. And we are now, by means in a static condition, socially, economically, or physically, any more than the so he's basically saying we're not static, any more than the geological formation of the present day is in a static condition, although both man and rocks may seem to be.
you know, there's probably a saying about everything stays the same, nothing changes, everything stays the same, or the rock is a rock and it's unmoving. But over time, we do see changes. We do see weathering and erosion and forces of nature. And the same thing for people and plants. We are, in fact, even when we look at a table or something that appears to be solid, the molecular structure within it is constantly moving and dynamic. We don't have X-ray vision or that microscopic view into everything at all times. And there must be a reason why we as humans have the kind of vision that we do. What is it? What is our purpose on the planet that our vision is? Just if we don't use something extraordinary like Google Glasses that change our vision and make us into robots or superhumans. What is it? Why do we were we born with this faculty and this means of a vision and color and black and white and light and dark? So as he says, in reality, we are continually in balance between dynamical laws and statistical laws, which are defined by Reiser as follows. So I don't know that whether this is a quote, but he says, the duality of natural law is stated in terms of contrast between dynamical and statistical laws. The first type, dynamical laws, they are causal laws, giving rigid determination and predictability. And the second type, statistical laws, yield more probability and introduce indeterminism into the calculations. Probably, you know, when we take risk-safety ratio factors based on statistics, that is based on probability, our need for security and insurance and protecting ourselves based on these kinds of laws, of statistical laws. But in actuality, what is the how does the dynamic law come into play? A dynamical or causal law eliminates contingency and implies ability to visualize the mechanisms in operation. But in statistical laws concerned with the calculation of mean values, individual elements of the statistical ensemble are not studied. The atomic processes of the microscopic mechanisms are reversible, sometimes periodically, and subject to necessary causal laws, whereas the macroscopic states represent the mean value of a large number of individual processes of a statistical aggregate. So kind of we're looking at these figures as an aggregate of large numbers. When we look at the statistical values and statistical laws, but when we look at the dynamical laws, we're concerned with more of the individuals. The causal law eliminates contingency. We would have to kind of think about what he's talking about here by eliminating contingency and implies ability to visualize the mechanisms in operation. So we're looking at something that's actually working, functioning, and getting responses back from individuals and groups rather than putting it into if there's a flow there, as opposed to statistical law, which is more, I would say, static and less real. We're not making it applicable to each individual. It is in this balance between dynamical and statistical laws that we find our margin of error in the application of homeopathic principles to our patients. The law of least action is one of the dynamical laws upon which homeopathy was postulated and by which it has been affirmed. We acknowledge this law along with the law of similars, and various other casual elements having to do with basic and cyclic action in natural processes, which in turn explain the processes of homeopathic action. And very often, let's say if we look at that vaccine statistical template or graph again, we are constantly being told that these vaccinations are protecting people from epidemic contagious disease. Yet, if you take a step back and look at the life of the disease, you find that they do have their own dynamic rhythm themselves, that they come and they go in a certain number of yearly patterns, and they come into being or out of their containment based on something that is necessary in society that will help move them forward in the evolution of the humans, the evolution of the population of the planet, or in different areas of the planet. So we have to look at this cyclical action of the natural process and less at the static, cutting out a little piece of the graph to say, aha, we introduced a vaccine and now the disease is waning or going. But if you step back and look at the larger picture, when in actuality, what happened before the vaccine? And if you look at that, you'll see that that disease was already on the decline. It was already waning and on its way out. So back to the reading of Dr. Herbert Roberts, he says it has been argued that if homeopathy is the application of natural laws, the results of our remedies should be uniform. There should be less variation in the details of provings. The length of action of any potency should be the same in all cases. No matter how careful the practitioner may be, he knows from bitter experience his failures, in spite of the most careful study and prescribing. There is no satisfaction in asserting that it is the failure of the prescriber. It is unsatisfactory to accept the statement that variation in living conditions may be the cause. We can allow a margin for hereditary tendencies and again for psychic or other forces, which we understand too little, that govern the threads of our lifespan. But beyond all this, there are factors in the variation of remedy action that we are unable to understand. We may say that statistical laws authorize us to expect certain results from those dynamical laws which we attempt to utilize. That, in turn, these statistical laws presuppose conditions pre-existing and perhaps unknown to us. But we may say, with more truth, that our incomplete understanding of dynamical laws causes us to assume statistical laws because it is a comfortable and convenient excuse. Our danger here lies in practicing empiricism because of our dependence upon statistical laws. So what is he telling us? That we do rely on statistics. We rely on math. We rely on what is comfortable. We rely on wanting things to be the same and repetitive because that's what we think science is, proof that if you can repeat the experiment again and again, that's proof that it's valid. So he's saying, even though homeopaths may prescribe a homeopathic remedy expecting the outcome to be a certain way, normally positive, we wonder why we have failures or why it doesn't work in a set of circumstances when it worked in a previous set of similar circumstances. So he's saying that it is dependent upon the dynamical laws which we attempt to utilize, and that there's information that we as humans are not all-knowing. We're not omnipotent. We are just taking a small portion
of all of the factors and all of the information and all of the dynamics that go into living. And therefore, sometimes when a homeopath chooses a remedy expecting a certain outcome, it may not be what they expect. What does he say? Certainly, we know that we have a variable force with which to deal in treating the sick. On the other hand, we question whether we have not a variable force with which to deal in our remedies. Okay, so I wanted to point that out. He's saying, what are the dynamics of the remedy itself? We have the dynamics of the sick organism, the sick individual. We also have the dynamics of the remedy. So how do those two interact? He says, if the impulse of a force is equal to the change of momentum produced by it, as we are told in physics, we prove the power of the potentized remedies after administration by the clinical evidence in direct proportion to the production of symptoms on the healthy human being. So you're going to see the outcome and demonstrable outcome. You're going to be able to measure it because you can see how that potentized force is going to impact on directly onto the healthy human being. He says, perhaps it is unfortunate that we have no measurable record of sickness or health per se. There is no determinable level of health. So I guess he's saying at our baseline, everybody starts at a different level of health. Our imperfect senses, he tells us we are imperfect, are incapable of perfect registration or infallible translation of symptoms. Our probability of error is doubled when we deal with another, the sick individual. We review our results by the clinical formula. The velocity of reaction is equal to the driving force divided by the resistance. Equal and opposite reactions, right? These equal and opposite forces. Unfortunately, we cannot know with precision either the actual driving force or the resistance. So the driving force would be the potentized remedy, and the resistance would be the unhealthy individual. Yet, within certain limited fields, we begin to measure the reactability of the substances, animal, vegetable, and mineral, that form the basis of our potencies. Elementary work of this nature has been carried on, but it is far from having been perfected. It is enough to recognize that within the atom lies the solution to the problem of reaction of the various potencies. This is like stating that the atom is in structure, much like the structure of the universe, and that the composition of the atom, like the universe, is made up of a similar solar system with planetary revolutions in their orbits. We draw the analogy from the atom offers the solution to universal physics, and that the universe itself offers aid in understanding our specific problems. Surely, this is a phenomenological view of the homeopathic field. So, in a way, where he's looking under the microscope and looking at the atom, it might be an electron microscope, and then he's taking the view, the distant view, at through the telescope to see the solar system, to see the planets and the stars and how the universe is made up, and using the science of physics to understand the forces of nature, just like the force of the atom in all its parts and the force of the planets and the stars and the rotations. He says, nevertheless, we suggest that these peculiarly pertinent questions are not pertinent to universal breath and embrace our very reasons for existence. Consider again the question of potency. This has been a stumbling block to many since Hahnemann's development of potentization. Modern science teaches that energy is automatically thrown off in proportion to the weight of the atom. Those of high atomic weight that are radioactive give off their own peculiar energy in proportionately high degree, destroying themselves in the process. If the atomic weight is lower, there is less intrinsic radiation, and it becomes necessary to apply force to release the energy, until, in the low atomic weights, more energy may be required to release the potential energy than thrift warrants. The erg unit being the expended effort and result. Yet, for curative purposes, it is probable that we might find the raw atom, as we express it, entirely unfitted for our uses, and that the energy expended to break up that fission, break up the atomic structure sufficiently to release the electrical, electromagnetic, and magnetic orbits into malleable form for our purpose to be a sound investment of time and energy, time and effort. It sounds like Dr. Herbert Roberts may not have been a proponent of nuclear energy because of the amount of energy it takes to break up the atomic structure. Consider lime and its various material uses. Consider how ineffective for physiological construction it is in its crude form, and indeed how often it promotes rickets in children when introduced as lime water into the feeding formula. On the other hand, for countless conditions besides patients that have rickets, the homeopathic physician could ill afford to be without potentized calcium, which is probably lime, and infinitesimal amounts exhibit astoundingly curative results. And we know that calcium or calcarea carb is used to support the development of infants and children to create sound, strong bones, hair, and teeth. Recent developments in the study of the vitamins have demonstrated that in the lower triturations, these become well nigh inert. But by raising them to higher potencies in fluid form, their activity and potent influence is markedly increased. So he's saying that these are the types of things that we might say are inert. They have no activity. They have no action. But when you start to potentize them homeopathically, triturating them, grinding them, diluting them, and succussing them, pounding them, to release their energy, they do become active. And this leads us to meditate upon the comparative value of trituration and succussion as a means of stimulating the atom to release of energy. So, in other words, homeopaths are creating their own little nuclear energy plant by manufacturing plant by basically releasing the energy of the plants, minerals, and animals that we prepare as homeopathic preparations. It is impossible, of course, to attack the atom of lime by the same measures one employs to attack the molecular formation of plants. In some substances, it is imperative to break down the bulk by trituration, grinding it and pounding it, while others are soluble in water and thus approach the state where the potential energy may be most readily to release. If we were able to view the actual composition of the atom and its permeability, we might gain a fair idea of the reasons for energy release under different methods. This problem is allied equally to the construction of the atom and its destruction, with the result of wresting from it the greatest possible degree of its peculiar and intrinsic energy. In viewing our potencies, we find the statistical laws govern in Materia Medica when we casually assume that remedy provings in the lower dilutions will be applicable in equal degree and unvaryingly in the highest potencies. Okay, so he's saying that the dynamics in are different based upon the different potentizations of our remedies. He says we find the statistical laws govern in Materia Medica when we casually assume that remedy provings in the lower dilutions will be applicable in equal degree and unvaryingly in the highest potencies. Okay, so what he's telling us is that we try and use that measurable statistics and apply what we know from the lower potencies, maybe 6x or 6e or 12c, and we say it's going to be the same dynamic result in the higher potencies, where he's saying that's really hypothetical, that it may not actually be true because the dynamism of the energy may have changed at a higher potency. He says, again, we assume that any potency, say the 200th, is always to be dependent upon for uniform results, in spite of widely varying methods of development. To be sure, experience has taught us that certain remedies have certain symptoms, which are more or less fixed in all provings, and which act with greater or less regularity, sufficient as a basis for statistical observations when applied clinically. So he's telling us that you might think that the 200th potency of each and every remedy is going to have a particular uniform result, where he's saying that it really varies, it widely varies. To be sure that the experience has taught us certain remedies have certain symptoms, which are more or less fixed in all provings, and which act with greater or less regularity. So they regularly, you can depend upon them or not depend upon them, acting in a certain way, sufficient as a basis for statistical observations when applied clinically. So in the clinic, when you apply the knowledge that you have about the statistical regularity of the symptom picture from a particular remedy, you can do that. You can with the proving, with which act with greater or less regularity. So there is variability within the regularity in which it works, but there's a extremes limitation of what it will. It will work within 2 points, within A and B, there will be an outcome of reliability. Herein lies our art in homeopathy, says Dr. Herbert Roberts. But just here, we lay ourselves open to criticism as being the scientists we claim to be. Millikan tells us that under bombardment by alpha rays, an element may be built up to a higher atomic level. At the same time, neutrons may be thrown off as a byproduct of artificial transmutation. This is how we create some of our newer elements on the periodic chart, by bombarding them with these rays and knocking out some of the electrons. These neutrons are presumably, or maybe the neutrons may be thrown out. The neutrons are presumably constituents of all nuclei except hydrogen, and many nuclear transformations throw them out. Neutrons carry no electric charge, yet they are themselves weapons that may be hurried into atomic targets, making the atom unstable. This instability tends to step the atom down 1 degree, and a proton nucleus of hydrogen flies out. Millikan tells us further that the neutron does not require great energy to get into a nucleus to transform it. If it does so, If it does so with violence, the result is to shatter the nucleus and thus produce several substances of smaller atomic weight than the struck nucleus itself. On the other hand, it tends to fall in more easily and oftener when they have slow speeds than when they try to force their way in with violence. In this way, it adds its mass to that of the nucleus so that the process results in the quiet building up of a heavier atom. And this is something that I think we're seeing in the universe today, on the planet and the populations, that we're learning that gentle ways are going to create change and be building, be productive, accumulative, better effect, whereas when we use violence and force, we break things apart, we cause destruction, we cause loss, we cause grief, we cause all sorts of things that are not productive in the universe, in the planet, in populations, when we use force as opposed to doing something very gently. And you can apply this to just about anything, I suppose. Now I'm going to go ahead and take a quick look and to see if anybody is listening on the Blog Talk Radio. If you wanted to call in, the number is 347-945-6956 if anybody's listening. If anybody wants to go on the chat, I'm welcoming you there. So we're going to continue on. So far, no technique has been devised to determine what the relation of trituration and succussion to energy release really means to the homeopathic preparation of remedies. And I don't know whether that has changed in the last 60 years or so since he's written this book. Whether we actually change the character of the elements with which we deal, and if so, whether or not this is in a fixed ratio, is a problem for the homeopathic physicist. This is a field not yet developed, but one that offers a challenge to homeopathy. Here is an open question to intrigue the mind of science, a problem that, if solved in its elementary aspects, would place homeopathic principles on a footing with the field attained by the foremost scientific pioneers in physics. And it's possible some of our physicists today, talking about nanotechnology and how water molecules change, would be a scope for Dr. Herbert Roberts to have intrigue. Here we are faced with another problem in physics, which has to do with the single remedy, or polypharmacy. There is a reason for the single remedy, even more profound than that practical one, first advanced by Hahnemann and his followers, that since we know from careful provings what the single remedy will do, we can depend upon it in its uniformity within certain limitations. But no one can predict the action of more than one remedy in combination, or in alternation, or in close proximity to each other. This is an observation, not an explanation. So he's saying we would need to learn what would be the outcomes of individual remedies when they become combined in alternation or in close proximity to each other. Modern physics may give us the solution in the wandering neutron, and neutrons are evidently loosened when certain elements of low atomic weight are combined, even with an infinitesimal weight of radiations of an element of high atomic weight. And these neutrons, in turn, readily combine with other elements with which they come in contact. So these neutrons, when they're gently combined, they're going to meld, they're going to create something new, an element of high atomic weight. And these neutrons, in turn,
readily combine with elements with which they come in contact. So maybe he's implying to us that when we combine different homeopathic remedies, they also combined. Let's see. And while these elements of the third state do not necessarily become changed, they become unstable and, again, subject to further changes. So he's saying that the atom, the neutrons become unstable and therefore they can change more readily. Millikan quotes the case of, quote, a bit of beryllium mixed with an infinitesimal amount of radium emanation, unquote, where one of the neutrons released enters the nucleus of an atom of silver and thus raises the atomic weight of the silver one unit, the silver becoming extra heavy, still retaining its chemical properties, but becoming unstable, and proceeding to throw out a negative electron and transforming itself into cadmium. So that means silver turned into cadmium. To be sure, these changes were the result of experimental procedures, but we cannot be assured that any combination of elements might not produce just as profound changes, either constructive or destructive. This would be particularly true when we consider the methods we employ to release the inherent energy in seemingly inert substances. In our methods are sufficient to release energy, we cannot be assured that they might not be transmuted. So he says in our methods that we as homeopaths use to release energy in order to heal, even though they might on a low level seem inert, we release them through the homeopathic potentization process. We cannot be assured that they might not be transmuted in some way. They might be transformed. A further problem in potentization presents itself to our inquiring minds. If our methods are sufficiently practical to release these energies, and we must admit that the potential powers of our high potencies often startle us with their reaction, we may well inquire to just what degree the atoms of the elements are broken up in these substances. So he says that when we potentize, we're breaking up the atoms of these substances in order to release their energy. Unquestionably, there is some definite ratio of energy release from the various elements, but to what extent trituration or succussion touches the atomic structure itself, we do not know. If we could know that our application of force to these substances actually broke up the atom, we would recognize as a corollary that the destruction of the elemental atom and the consequent release of protons and neutrons tended toward the actual formation of different elements with different atomic structures, and that these in turn had their own rates of energy, which might be stabilized or unstabilized under certain conditions and combinations. Now, this is really getting fascinating. It's sort of like we are able to see with our eyes a rainbow of colors, a spectrum of light colors, and we delineate yellow and lemon yellow and bright yellow and yellow ochre and all these different colors. But because there is a continuum in that rainbow of colors, there's spaces in between the colors that we give a name to. And are we able to say that the elements that we are, the substances we are potentizing and releasing their elements, their energy from the atomic structure, are we able to measure the minute amount of change of energy release that's going on through the process of potentization? Not that we can detect it with
the devices that we have now to measure it, just like we can give the colors a name, but the colors in between what we give a name, they're still there. And so this energy release might have changed the basic atom as we know it and transmuted it, which is quite fascinating to think about. So what does he say? This suggests further study of the composite substances, such as the plant remedies. It has not yet been demonstrated that living substance contains radioactive elements. But when we consider the implication of such experiments as those cited by Millikan, we may question the reaction set up by breaking down elements of various atomic weights, even in the lower registers, and their interaction. Further, the reaction of these changes, changing energies, upon the molecular construction of the individual is something upon which we may ponder. So if I am reading him correctly, we use a Geiger counter to measure radioactivity, and it measures a certain quantification. Is it possible that everything has a quantification of radioactivity that we're not able to measure on that Geiger counter because it's so low? But we do know that when we do carbon dating of older materials, of artifacts, that we can measure the radioactivity of those substances because of the change over the course of thousands of years. So now let's look at this. Seemingly, he says, these problems are beyond the scope of the physician. We feel impelled to know some of our materia medica and a few simple principles for the administration of our remedies. In other words, we naturally take a nearsighted view of our work. If we take the wider view, the phenomenological view, we see that these problems demand a more thorough understanding of our work. They express only a proper appreciation of our science and art. Even the United States Department of Public Health is recognizing the fact that their selenium is found near the surface, which occurs in only a few places in this country. The impaired health of the community makes continued habitation impractical and dangerous. Selenium ranks 34 on the scale of atomic weights between arsenic and bromine and falls considerably below those radioactive elements that have long been known to be dangerous and dangerous neighbors. And strangely, he picks up on the remedy selenium, which we know is good for cancer patients and for prostate problems. So it's an important element today, a very necessary element for human survival and healthy survival. The series of airplane accidents on our Pacific coast in the years 1936 and 37 has been attributed to the influence of uranium fields where the deposits approach the surface in certain places in California. Uranium is one of the very heaviest of elements, number 92 in the scale. It is highly radioactive, and it is believed that these radiations disturb the delicate instruments so that they became useless. Hence, the tragedies occurred. So that is years bygone before the instrument panels changed on airplanes. Consider the patients. We recognize this important modality and blood for the profound reason behind it. We are told that cosmic rays are 5.5 times as destructive at an altitude of 14,000 feet compared to sea level. Cosmic rays are essentially destructive to all elements, especially the radioactive. And we know that this is true, that the higher up that you go in elevation, you're going to get these radioactive elements in the air. and cesium and all these other things coming in, especially from the nuclear fallout now from power plants, meltdown of the cores of these different plants. So he says, subjecting a patient hampered through his circulatory system, his vital balance already impaired, to forces known to be destructive might easily be fatal. It may be significant that these heart conditions often fall into the class of those conditions we recognize as being syphilitic or psychotic in origin, using syphilitic and psychotic in the sense of either the acquired disease or the inherited dyscrasia. And I'm just going to check once again for those folks who are listening to me today on Blog Talk Radio, and I appreciate that anybody is listening today. And I want to continue on. I think we have a little bit more time for this talk. We have about 45 minutes. I might just keep rambling on if you're still with me and learning. He's really got fascinating theory going on about potentization and releasing these energies and dynamics and statistical viewpoint and phenomenological viewpoint. So things we say are phenomenal. Okay, he's saying that subjecting a person who has a problem with their heart, a patient hampered through his circulatory system, through his vital balance is already impaired, he's already weakened, and to forces that are known to be destructive, which would be high altitudes, might easily be fatal, especially if he's not getting enough oxygen at the higher altitudes. It may be significant that these heart conditions often fall into the class of those conditions we recognize as being syphilitic or psychotic in origin, using syphilitic and psychotic in the sense of either the acquired disease or the inherited dyscrasia. So either they had something that happened in their life that their heart was weakened, or because of their hereditary factors. The remedies applicable in these conditions, as we have pointed out previously, are remedies that in the majority are rated in the radioactive group. And I'm going to check in on the chat one more time. And thank you all for being patient with me. And so he says, the remedies applicable in these conditions, as we have pointed out previously, are remedies that in the majority are rated in the radioactive group. On the other hand, the patient who suffers from atmospheric pressure and the dampness of sea level flourishes at higher altitudes. So people who have problems at going to the Dead Sea, they do better when they go to the higher altitudes. We have previously discussed the problem of psychosis as a probable overstimulation of growth and development of certain body cells. If this individual is exposed to increased bombardment by the cosmic rays, this tends to balance the disease state, and the patient enjoys a much more stable equilibrium. So he's saying that there are other people who take their vacation at the high altitudes, go to the mountains, and they feel a whole lot better. And he's trying to give us some kind of an explanation for how or why this may be. Here in the field of the atom lies the final answer to our questions of sickness and health, the problems of conception, growth, vital balance, and decay. Here lies the answer to our problem of cure, maintenance of normal development, retention of vital balance, insurance against premature decay. This is a challenge to the scientist with an understanding of the homeopathic principles and their application.
or to the homeopathic scientist who comprehends the phenomena of the structure of the universe, not in a study of the individual six cells, but of the universe and the universal law reflected in the universal structure of each elemental atom, shall we find our clarified view. So he's saying, don't look under the microscope at the six cells. Look more at the universe reflected in the atom, reflected in the planets. That is the end of this particular chapter in The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy, written by Dr. Herbert Roberts, MD, chapter number 33, The Phenomenological Viewpoint. And so, I mean, he is a theoretician. He is trying to understand physics. He's trying to understand how it is possible at all that homeopathy could work. What is the scientific basis for it? And we have so many wonderful, wonderful authors today, homeopaths today, who are doing the same kind of work and giving explanations. I posted on Homeopathy World Community a video by Dr. Rajan Sankaran, who explains his point of view. The next chapter from Dr. Roberts, which I will read on another session, is chapter 14, The Deflected Current. And there will be, out of all these chapters, two more, The Deflected Current and Modern Medication and the Homeopathic Principles. Dr. Herbert Roberts says that his work, all of these wonderful chapters, they are archived for your listening pleasure. This work is dedicated to all seekers after truth in healing of every age and every race. He wrote this book, The Principles and Art of Cure by Homeopathy, specifically for students in medicine, for practitioners in medicine, and for lay people to understand more about homeopathy. And we need to continue to study and learn. On that new note, let's say that there is a new immune system that was discovered. I have this article that says a research team led by Jeremy Barr, a biology postdoctoral fellow, unveiled a new immune system that protects humans and animals from infection. In this previously undocumented immune system, you know, I would say, you know, when they find these new things, is anything new under the sun? Do homeopaths already know about all of this stuff? Is it possibly miasms? I don't know. Let's see what he says. In this previously undocumented immune system, researchers uncovered bacteria infecting viruses known as bacteriophage, which shield the body from invading infection. And what does that tell you? If you use an antibiotic, it's kind of broad spectrum, and it kills all of the lovely bacteria that your body over years has developed as a home, and you're hosting them, and you're feeding them, and you're encouraging them to do their job, which they are, like, that's why they're there, and they're finding out that these bacteriophages are shielding your body from invading infection, and you go in and take an antibiotic and wipe them all out, you're losing your immunity. You're not gaining your immunity. You're destroying your immunity. You're not protecting your immunity. The discovery made possible with funding from the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, concentrates on the protective layers of mucus. Wow, what do we know about mucus? That is our natural protective mechanisms, and that's the natural way that we incur contagious diseases. Proximity, that when one person sneezes or coughs or touches you and it touches the mucous membrane, that's how you're transmitting these bacteria or virus. It says that it concentrates on the protective layers of your mucus. So there you go. You've got your own personal shield right there in your mucus membranes, which are present in all humans and animals. It serves both as a home for large populations of beneficial microbes, which can include fungi, bacteria, and viruses, and as an entry point for infection. And the only way it could be an entry point is if there's something not right. And those factors might be pH might not be right. We're feeding ourselves too much sugar. That might be right, not be right. We might be having an imbalance in our emotional state. That might not be right. And in those cases, any shocks or stresses can change the mucous membranes and let the door open for an invader. So he says, that the new immune system, the researchers sampled mucus from animals and humans, ranging from a sea anemone to a mouse and a person, and found that the bacteriophage adheres to the mucus layers on all of them. They placed these bacteriophages on top of the layer of mucus producing tissue and observed that the bacteriophage formed bonds with sugars within the mucus, causing them to adhere to the surface. They then challenged these mucus cells, with E. coli bacteria and found that the bacteriophage attacked and killed off the E. coli in the mucus, effectively forming an antimicrobial barrier on the host that protected from infection and disease. And, you know, there's probably a heck of a lot more we're going to learn about this and lots more different things that we're learning under the microscope that give us some insight and answers and explanations and understanding, but we must also realize that our senses tell us a lot. Does it make sense to take an antibiotic when so many people have side effects from them? They end up with yeast infections. They end up with indigestive problems. They end up with chronic digestive and bowel disease. Here's another article. It's about from naturalsociety.com, GMO gene splicing lunacy. Cabbages mixed with scorpion poison. Okay, would you consider scorpion venom safe? Is that how we evolved over time as humans? Are we making something new that is not part of our universal energy? The next safe GMO food for you to consume is genetically altered cabbage. And you know, cabbage is so healthy for us. It's anti-cancer and good for our digestion. And that has been gene spliced with scorpion venom because it is more resistant to Roundup. Who is going to benefit from this Roundup Ready chemicals? Is it you? Is it me? Or is it a chemical corporation that's going to benefit from this type of transition, creation, frankenfood? And of course, they're telling us it is safe. And they always tell us these things are safe. And then 10, 20, 30 years down the line, they disclose the truth of what they always knew. And then they might have to take it off the market, possibly, depending on how much they can pay off the government. The brain children of the likes of Monsanto and Dow get progressively ludicrous, this article says. Okay. In 1994, the scorpion poison pesticide was made and tested by spraying it in a field with scientists who wore full hazmat suits to protect them from it. Even the lead scientist in charge of running the trial was absent from the spray. Perhaps David Bishop was just as worried as we are about scorpion cabbages. You know, they take some kind of protection for themselves, just like when we get x-rays in the dental office. If you don't ask for a guard for your neck to protect your thyroid, you might not get it. But they go and they walk out behind a lead wall to protect themselves. So when they do all of these genetic engineerings, they do take precautionary steps to protect themselves. What about the people that they're going to feed these things to? Now, in 2013, the same genetic engineering is utilizing genes from the scorpion, and this is the Androdectonus australis hector, the crossbreed with cabbages. We know homeopathically that Jeremy Scheer has done provings on scorpion, and it has wide range of wonderful properties for healing. I might be able to look up something. Let's see if I can. Androdectonus. Okay, it may not be the exact same scorpion. And it looks like we would have to do some kind of scrounging up on the internet to find it, because it's a special proving. Anyway, that's something for you to think about. And here's the last question, to vaccinate or not vaccinate. I'm going to check my time here. About 30 minutes if anybody's still hanging in there with me. To vaccinate or not vaccinate. This is supposedly reading for everyone. Vaccine thoughts. Smallpox eradicated using the Indian vaccination system, which has a unique science based on Ayurveda. P. Hallwell, FRS, who came to India to study the science and then took the details back to England in 1747. Encouraged by the success, the business lobbies had been trying to get a vaccine for every conceivable disease. What is the science behind it? How effective is the system based on that area? Are some of the questions nagging thinkers in the field? Are they nagging all of us? Because we want to know how effective these things are. Let us examine the science behind vaccination. Having a disease, yes, having the disease will confer immunity, certainly partially stimulating the immune system. Might not give you the adequate evolution of our body with nature. The membrane, which we just learned about, those macrophages, and we are having traits due to infectious disease, came down long before even their causes were known, and definitely much before any drug therapy or vaccination came onto the market. The immune system can function optimally when the body's protein levels are fine, for antibodies are proteins. Here's the crux of the matter. Malnourished children, who form a large chunk of the world's malnutrition load, nearly 67 million in India alone, are not the best targets for immunization policies, as their response will not be really wonderful, because they don't have the immunization that they make properly if they're already weak. The orally given attenuated viruses mutate in children's guts to become virulent strains like P1 and P3. The mutated virus comes out in their feces and hijacks surroundings, the places they go to the bathroom. There's no toilets. It's just plain open stream or open landscape. And anybody in the proximity can easily spread this virus to other healthy children. And in fact, the only way that it seems like we have all of these diseases today is through the spread from the vaccines. Some studies have estimated that nearly 27,000 Indians have had vaccine
poliomyelitis till this date. Medical textbooks do warn that malnourished children should never be given an oral polio vaccination. And you know what? If you read the label, if you can, when you go in, take your child in for a vaccine, you're not supposed to give a vaccine to a child who is not there for a well visit. If they're sick, if they're immune compromised, they're not supposed to be getting a vaccination. But it says that in India, that's what they do anyway, because they just want to fill in the chart and click, you know, check off a number that they have vaccinated so and so many children. Thanks to pressure from industry, politicians, and service organizations, the government's excuse is that parenteral vaccines, that's P-A-R-E-N-T-E-R-A-L, parenteral vaccines are expensive. And so parenteral mode of giving a medicine refers to the route in which the drug is administered by means other than the digestive tract, which they're talking about injection. The government's excuse is that the injection vaccines are expensive, and this is the reason to give oral vaccines that could be fatal. Many countries have already banned oral polio vaccine. Okay, so they're talking here about the oral polio vaccine as being less expensive than the injection, but that they're given because of money value. The MMR vaccinations have been making headlines, and the connection between autism and MMR has been the bone of contention between the industry and researchers. Of course, everybody knows by now about Dr. Andrew Wakefield, whose paper on autism was withdrawn from The Lancet, and he was stripped of his medical degree. And I think now we are getting a backlash on that, and he is being lauded as his work was actually important and should not have been dismissed, and there was a witch hunt against him. At the forefront of this attack was Fiona Godley, the editor of the prestigious British Medical Journal, and the journalist in London. This year has been a blessing for Dr. Andrew Wakefield, for many other researchers have shown the connection between MMR and autism, and has filed a defamation suit against the BMJ and to uphold Dr. Wakefield's reputation. They even suggested in this particular article that the BMJ received a large amount of cash for doing what they did from the vaccine manufacturer, but it's only conjecture. And here's more information. The Lancet shows a meta-analysis of six large vaccine outcome studies that tell about our expectations. Quote, influenza vaccines can provide moderate protection against virologically confirmed influenza, but such protection is greatly reduced or absent in some seasons. Evidence in protection in adults age 65 and older is lacking. So you don't want to give these vaccines to the elderly. And also, these LAIVs consistently show high efficacy in young children, that's age 6 months to 7 years. New vaccines with improved clinical efficacy and effectiveness are needed to further reduce influenza-related morbidity and mortality. And this is from The Lancet Infectious Disease, Volume 12, Issue 1, January 2012. According to the International Medical Council on Vaccination, diseases that have documented associations with vaccines include autism, cancer, sudden infant death, and many neurological and autoimmune disease. Though publicly denied by government health authorities, the evidence is mounting that vaccinated children suffer a significant decline in health compared to unvaccinated children. The council cites a study of 17,674 children. Those who were vaccinated had 120% more asthma, 146% more autism, 317% more ADHD than those children who were unvaccinated. And we could go on with this, and I'm sure you're going to hear a lot more tomorrow on Blog Talk Radio, Homeopathy World Community, with Alan Phillips and Greg Glazer, and with Rich Roberts. That'll be at 1 o'clock tomorrow, Thursday, regular day. And what kind of actions can you take if you go to Homeopathy World Community on Facebook? You will be able to see, if you probably have to scroll down pretty far to find it, and that would be some of the petitions. There are plenty of petitions. Maybe we should put them all in one place. And that is regarding saving homeopathy in Canada, in France, in Britain, in the U.S. There's constant attacks, and you can be supporting homeopathy in your small way that you can do it. I found, do you know what those captchas are? When you comment at the bottom of a blog on WordPress or elsewhere, you have to fill out to check that you are a live living person and not a robot or a, what are they called? Well, whatever they are, they're not real. And you enter it, and I came upon one that's the first time. Usually they're strange words, they're make-believe words, they're not even real. And there was one that said, "Know thyself." And I said, "That's pretty cool, know thyself." And so I did take a picture of it, I took a screenshot, and it made me think. Here's a quote from Doris Mortman that says, "Until you make peace with who you are, you'll never be content with what you have." That's Doris Mortman. And also, Lao Tzu said, "He who knows others is wise. He who knows himself is enlightened." And so that's why I looked up something that reflected, "Know thyself." If you know yourself, you are enlightened. There's tons and tons to read and look at on the internet. You know, anybody who follows Homeopathy World Community or visits our page, we are in so much gratitude to you for checking in with us, simply because I know your attention could go literally anywhere on the internet. I wanted to let you know that last Monday, we spoke with Dr. Stephen Blake about hypothyroidism in dogs and learned quite a few tidbits, tricks, and information about keeping your yard free of mosquitoes, for one thing, bugs, and also about how to, his basic ABCs approach toward his clients, which are pets, dogs, cats, birds, elephants, whatever they, dolphins. So why don't you tune in and watch that Health In show to learn a little bit about his approach. Then we have superior doctors prevent the disease. Mediocre doctors treat the disease before it's evident, but inferior doctors treat the full-blown disease. So what does that mean? That is by Huan Di Nanchang, the first Chinese medical text dated in BC, to prevent disease. And do you think you prevent disease with a vaccine? I doubt it, because all the people who are getting now contagious disease have the vaccine. So it's not working out. Voltaire said, "To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticize." And this is something that is happening everywhere, in schools, in papers, in blogs, on Twitter, wherever you are, in in community groups. It's called bullying, whether it's cyberbullying or bullying, period. Some people are trying to squash you. They're trying to not let you speak or be who you are or to thy own self be true. And this is also happening globally and governmentally to dominate other people. And this is why we must, those people who want freedom, July 4th is what we're going to be celebrating in about 15 minutes. If you really want freedom of expression, as long as you're not hurting another human being, then we have to fight for it. We have to stand up and not be afraid to speak out. And if I can find the greatest wealth by Publius Virgilius Maro in 70 BC, 19 BC, an ancient Roman poet of the Augustan period, people knew these things from time and eternity. It is universal. And I'm just trying to find if there's a place that you're going to have to scroll down pretty far on Homeopathy World Community Facebook to find the action items, although you can always click and share. That's one thing that you can do. And enjoy the learning. Enjoy the inspirational quotes. Review. Each of them have also on this website, the health show, which I and little items put together on Facebook. Well, it must be now we've already done about that's a lot of fun. People are being very creative in the way that they demonstrate their love for homeopathy. You can just check in here. What else are important things that you might want to know or see? That homeopathy is up and coming. It is mainstream. One third of Americans are swapping their over-the-counter medicines because they know that side effects and are long-term, and also don't forget about addictions to drugs. So, you know, I could tell you about music. I want to tell you about a special program that is produced by Free and Healthy Children International in Minnesota by Church and Sila Watcott. It's called Homeoprophylaxis. They call it HP for short. It's a form of homeopathy for disease prevention. It's a 44-month program for children administered by parents. So it is up for, it is your independence, your choice to choose to educate your child's immune system, condition it through the administration of homeoprophylaxis. If you choose to do this, if you're a parent, you need to find a supervised, qualified homeopath or medical practitioner who has had the training and understands what the program is about, because this is data collection program from children all around the world, hundreds and hundreds of children, and hundreds of supervisors. It uses the homeopathic nosodes, homeopathic nanodilutions of diseased tissue or pathogens, to educate your child's immune system. It's easily administered orally as a tiny sugar pellet. So very much what you would say when I was a child, I got the oral polio vaccine, a little sugar cube. It's much, much smaller than that. It's easy to take, and the child is fairly happy to do so. The remedies are made in homeopathic pharmacies overseen by the HPUS, a branch of the FDA. Homeoprophylaxis stimulates the natural immune system response and enhances normal childhood development. You can go and find out more about it if you go to the solution, Homeoprophylaxis, the vaccine alternative. There is a link on the front page, on every page of Homeopathy World Community, to the solution book. There are seven major purposes in this program: to educate healthcare practitioners to the use of the homeoprophylaxis, to certify practitioners educated in HP and oversee continuing education, to oversee practitioners' implementation of this HP into their practices, to oversee data collection of the homeoprophylaxis for the prevention of infectious disease. So basically what we're doing is, over the course of years, and Dr. Isaac Golden has been doing this for 15 years and thousands of children, he's been collecting the data and finding out how the children who have taken the homeoprophylaxis NOSOs, homeopathic NOSOs, have fared when there have been disease epidemics, and in their general health. Now, their parents have been documenting what happens to them over the course of the 44 months and probably beyond that. To promote the access to the use of HP in North America and internationally. So this is an international program, and we want to let more people know that this is available to them. It protects their children's immune system and their health so that they may live a free and healthy life. So this is, again, you can go to FreeAndHealthyChildren.com. It's a nonprofit organization in Minnesota. You can make a donation to it. You can find lists of practitioners who are supervising, probably in your state, and they are committed to expanding the use and access of homeoprophylaxis. For short, it's called HP. And this is for the prevention of infectious contagious disease. A much more gentler approach than using toxins that bypass the natural immune system. And you will find the list of homeoprophylaxis supervisors on the website called vaccinefree.wordpress.com. And that's about it for that. And I want to thank everyone so much for tuning in, wishing you a very happy 4th of July. Tomorrow is Thursday. Alan Phillips, expert at maintaining your rights in the United States, up on what's happening congressionally, legislatively in the United States, in all of the different states. And just give him a call. Send him a note. He would love to be a keynote speaker. He would like to write for you and give you, you can hire him to help you with your exemption and waiver if you need assistance. Next Monday on the Health In Show, we are playing it by the seat of our pants. We don't have anything specifically scheduled, so we're going to see how we can play it by ear. And if you have anything you want to talk to me about, give me a call. I'll tell you what, lately I have been just scouring the websites, going here and there, learning about, I love to learn about different remedies and also about the environment and news. I have to be very proactive. So why don't I just, because I didn't start with the music today, and I didn't have a conversation with anybody except myself, I'll just play a song and let you enjoy the night. Thank you. This is Alan Phillips singing Freedom Song. Destiny Freedom Song, since he is a musician, lyricist, composer, and it will start in just a minute.
Across this land, both near and far, throughout the human race, within each beating heart, there is a dream whose time has come for us to claim our birthright, each and every one. Evil hands have intervened, controlling from the shadows, think they can't be seen. But we have eyes to see in the dark, to cast a light upon the madness we embark. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency, for we must be the masters of our destiny. Upon their face, sincerity, while underneath a self-agenda does proceed. But falsity perfumes the air, the sin screams louder than the finest debonair. They'll fill your place with GMOs, and soon your lineage will never cease to grow. Inject your blood with toxic waste. The world is all that bears if you'll just die in haste. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency, for we must be the masters of our destiny. Let freedom ring throughout the land. Let no one trade your soul for dollars, dirty hands. Demand the truth, transparency, for we must be the masters of our destiny. For we must be the masters of our destiny. For we must be the masters of our destiny.